There we go. This is once again a belated start to the recording for the class of August 29th, 2018, Environmental Law, where we're discussing the mysteries of public nuisance lawsuits. Now, Lena has just said that there are two factors. It's usually a government-held claim that the government's trying to vindicate, and it's also one that I think you said the public could.
Yeah. So it's something that the public enjoys.
Okay.
So instead of it being like your private land that's being interfered with, it's something that the general public follows.
Okay. So would it be a public nuisance if 1,000 members of the public decided they had enough and that Houston Ship Channel had stunk up their lives for way too long, and they all filed a nuisance lawsuit as a large group of the public against the schedule? If a large group of the members of the public all sued over an injury they share, is that a public nuisance? I heard a no. Why not?
Public nuisance needs to be brought by the government or the commonwealth or the people.
Okay.
In private nuisance, then that would be a private nuisance. Because it's brought, even if it's a large group, it is brought by the people.
Okay. So, I want to hold that thought. Why is it you think private citizens can never bring a public nuisance claim?
I think it's for the general public. So okay. It's the government who protects the general public. So public nuisance to me.
Okay. No. I want to make sure because this is a question that comes up over and over again.
Okay.
Hold that thought. I want to say it's not if it was more than just the identity. It was more than just the fact that the government had not brought this lawsuit. Is there anything else that you could point to that would say whether or not this kind of multi-mega lawsuit is a public nuisance or not? Jack?
I'm sorry, actually.
No. Talk to Jack.
All right, well then let me know. Is that okay? Yeah, Jack, go ahead.
The interference has to be with something that is a right commonly enjoyed by people. So if it's 1,000 persons, but the rest of the public doesn't enjoy that being interfered with, then you can't bring a public nuisance claim.
So what is something that would be enjoyed by the public that's different than something the individual?
I can't necessarily point to something that would be maybe different than what the entire public enjoys, but I don't know. So ordinarily public nuisance suits are things like air or drinking water or smell that the entire community, whereas maybe if you've got 1,000 farms and all of their crops are being affected by pesticide and there's some sort of chemical and the chemical doesn't affect the rest of the community, then in that instance you can bring public nuisance claim.
Is that what you're going to say as well?
I think the restatement sort of directs people to consider public health, safety, comfort, or convenience, and that's how it defines the common good.
Right.
And for a private actor or as opposed to the government to bring a public nuisance suit, they have to suffer some kind of special harm relative to the rest of the public. So they can't just be harmed in the same way the rest of the public is.
Absolutely. So that might actually go to whether the government is required to make a claim. Private citizens can, not in. I think the actual technical term of art is special injury. So, yes, we need two ingredients. We need either an interest held by the public at large. No one person has the need. Usually those are things like fishing rights. Usually are things like access to resources like the beaches. It may be things such as air quality, which are owned in your personal area. Those are undifferentiated rights held by the public at large, which can be the root of a public nuisance claim. The other is, absolutely correct, usually the state, by default, can vindicate the rights of the public with that undifferentiated rights of injury. But if you are of a small elect few who have the misfortune of being especially hurt by it, if there is a release to the air that causes all a degradation of the quality of the air for all, but the people close to it suffer serious health impacts that are different and qualitatively more important. They may have the ability to basically sue the same way the state would, even though everyone else could. So those are the two factors. Those are the kind of fingerprints for quality nuisance. Does that make sense? So quick reminder, we talked about two cases on that. Our poor Shlo Madison versus Ducktown, but then there was also Georgia v. Tennessee Common. Was that a public or private nuisance case, based on what we just talked about?
They
did, but what happened to the private nuisance claim? I like the flip. For anyone watching the video in the future, Chad just basically did an eloquent wrist flip. So like that was gutting your throat's rights. Yeah. Compared to injuring the air and the forests and the resources of the sovereign of the people of Georgia, definitely small things. Okay, so that means in heart, this is a public nuisance claim. All right, so with that in mind, there are two public nuisance cases. I'm picking up the second one tonight. So with that in mind, who would like to shoulder the load of the class and open the discussion on Missouri v. Illinois? Wow, Kyle, you guys have like lined up ready for this tonight. I appreciate it. Go for it.
So when Chicago was doing serious problems with pollution, and so what they ended up doing is they built a canal so that they could use Lake Michigan's water to push all their sewage into the Illinois River, which fed into the Mississippi River. And St. Louis, or Missouri, was not happy about it. And sewage for an injunction stopped with the canal.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, could I push you a little bit? This case caused a visceral reaction in you as you're reading the facts?
Yes.
Can you give us a little reason why perhaps the city of St. Louis felt so dimly about this rerouting of the water flow?
They were legitimately opening it for purity as a sewer. They were using Mississippi as a sewer, and that was the only place that we could help.
Absolutely. I say, I have to be careful. Every time I read this case, I make sure I'm not drinking or eating anything. So, I may elaborate a little bit on that as well, but you've captured the heart of it. So this took place around 1900. They actually opened the canal and changed the direction of the flow of a river. Magnificent feat of engineering to essentially turn St. Louis into Chicago's toilet. I think that's a fair interpretation. So of course, just as a St. Louis and St. Louisians, Missourians don't take this sort of crap, that's a bit. They don't take this sort of crap. Okay, so they sued. Can you tell us a little bit about the nature of their claim?
So they claimed that it was a nuisance and that the damages it was causing typhoid farmers, and that the mostly wanted the injunction to stop the typhoid outbreak because the typhoid bacillus apparently was making it from Chicago to St. Louis.
Okay. So before we go further, what was the lower court holding on this?
I think the lower court threw this out as a political question.
Ah, good answer, wrong case. No. This is a sneaky, dastardly, underhanded trick question. There was no underlying lower court case. I want to stress to you guys, this is a weird decision. It's original jurisdiction. This is two states suing each other. And during this time, they were able to trigger the mandatory jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. They had to hear it. What does that mean? Where's the jury? The jury is Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Yeah. It kind of creates impediments there. It also means that you lose the benefit of developing a trial record. It means that it was tried on affidavits. Essentially, some poor clerk was sitting in a windowless office in the U.S. Supreme Court, which I think still at that time was in the basement of the U.S. Senate, and trying to parse out what all this meant. So I'll talk about how this case would be handled today and how that might affect some of the things we talked about. But essentially what we have here is what he said, she said, between two different states. So any sense as to how Justice Holmes resolved the legal case?
He looked at it and said that you were not able to prove with enough evidence to truly show that it all came from one source. He said Missouri also comes into this river, and you're not going to set a standard on a different state that you yourself cannot follow.
Well, the justice, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Carl. That was another thing I got criticized for in my comments in my classes. I tend to interrupt people when I get excited. So, no disrespect intended. If you want to keep continuing your answer, but I had a question I thought might help your answer.
Sure.
Okay. What's the legal standard Justice Holmes set out to decide the case? To sort of decide, outline. Oh, I'm sorry, you have assistance from the back row.
So is the outline? Because I like number 8 years that it must be clear evidence of a real and substantial danger.
And where is that from?
That's from A2, the second paragraph after the case starts.
Can you read it out in a Holmesian voice with deep rolling baritone, with august severity and seriousness?
Before this court ought to intervene, the case should be of serious magnitude, clearly and fully proved, and the principle to be applied should be one which the court is prepared deliberately to maintain against all considerations on the other side.
All right, so three prongs and one very sonorous sentence. So what do they mean? So, serious magnitude? I'm assuming that means that there's at least some judicially noticed threshold of the gravity and magnitude of the harm or the interest involved to make it worth the court's while to weigh in. Second, I think it was sufficient proof, is that correct? Yes. All right, why would that matter? Why is that just preponderance of the evidence like any other civil case?
I think in this case, it's probably because the causal linkage between the sewage going in near the Great Lakes is looser. Well, between the sewage going in the Great Lakes and the typhoid fever in Missouri is tenuous. Mm-hmm. And so he wants to say something to the effect of, you know, this needs to be a higher standard here.
Then why didn't he make, remember who wrote Georgia v. Tennessee Power? 3 years earlier, Justice Holmes. Same guy, same public nuisance claim, same type of scenario. I don't think there was any discussion about having to prove with any kind of degree of conclusiveness. Kyle?
Is he worried about the precedential value of two states suing each other?
Georgia v. Tennessee, Copper, private party, two sovereign states. So having that degree of proof and serious magnitude reflects the sovereignty vested in the defendant as well as the plaintiff. All right, and then the last.
The principle to be applied to be one which the court is prepared deliberately to maintain against all considerations on the other side.
Could you translate that English, please?
The decision has to be one that we're going to stand by forever.
That's true of any case. That's what precedent is.
And
why would he go out of his way to say something so cryptic? Jack?
He's less pulled to a sort of case-by-case fix for this one, because this is something that happens a lot of the time. Like, people dump sewage into a lot of bodies of water, and he mentions later in the opinion, he's like, well, you know, you say that, you know, you put forth these allegations here, but are we going to have to rule against every single, you know, city that dumps sewage waste in every single city that has, you know, large amounts of people who develop type of work?
Fred and Allen, he said, well, we'll protect against one, we'll protect against the other. So I think that ties with what he's saying.
Right. If I could weave together all three comments, Jack is right. There's an element here that we're dealing with a common situation. And so if we like to imagine this case, we have to look forward to the fact that this court will be enmeshed in innumerable nuisance case. It's rooted in discharge of sewage by cities into rivers, which was the engineering solution at that time. But in addition as well, it's more than that. It's not just a question of the Supreme Court defending itself. It's also a question that they specifically say that Missouri needs to be ready to stand by this principle. When the court says hit a principle that would be used in all to come, they're talking about states have to live by their own claims. In this situation, Missouri was doing exactly the same thing. They were doing it upstream, closer to St. Louis. That has a couple of dimensions built into it. So, I'm sorry, now I'm getting ahead of myself. The private call the chance to deliver the coup de grace, the resolution of the case.
Oh, I think don't win.
Bless you. Can you elaborate a little bit? I like that you said they don't win, which is, you saved me from having to ask my favorite question. But nonetheless, there's something, hopefully there's more than Justice Holmes saying, Illinois wins, go home.
So pretty much, St. Louis should take preventative measures by filtration or otherwise, but as far as Chicago goes, they're allowed to keep dumping.
I'm not sure about
that. But I said, that's about the years that we just struggled with that campaign. So, keep going.
So, St. Louis did not prove that it was Chicago's dumping that was causing the tidal void. You did not make the case strong enough. I'm not going to rule.
That's just despite literally seeding the river with Typhus bacilli to see how long they make it down the river, despite having floating sacks of bacterial infection to measure how long they live in the water, despite the new germ theory, which Justice Holmes admits is true and doesn't even question at the start of the opinion, no proof.
Not strong enough.
So, in today's world, that there's been a genetic match, that's enough? There's nothing else in this opinion that might give some wiggle room here?
There are far too many sources.
Okay.
Of sewage coming from the upper. So, it's impossible to know which source was causing the increase in typhoid outbreaks from the city.
Okay. So, does that carry potentially a parallel, subtle, implicit argument? It's not just a matter of proving which bacilli got into the water that caused diseases of particular St. Louisians. It's a terrible term. What do they call themselves? Do you guys know? Sorry?
Yes, sir.
If you're from St. Louis, what do you call yourself?
Cardinals.
No. Ooh.
I like that we represent.
The National League. Sorry? Anyway, this is clearly not a legal topic. It's not just causation in that there's mixed causes potentially, it's that the other sources are in Missouri. So to a certain extent, there's also, to use a terrible metaphor, unclean hands issue. So, folding all that together, let me pose to you a couple of additional facts and background. This actually is a notorious situation and a notorious case historically. I'm not sure, in high school, are any of you still required to read Uptown Sinclair's The Jungle? Times moved on? Have any of you just...
Yeah.
Okay. He talks about this exact aqueduct. And I can't resist, because I actually had to read it in college, so I'll flick this on you. It's one paragraph. I'll be quick. Quote, "It is really a great open sewer, 100 or 2 feet wide. One long arm of it is lined, and the filth stays there forever and a day. The grease and chemicals that are poured into it undergo all sorts of strange transformations, which are the cause of its name. It is constantly in motion, as if huge fish were feeding it, or great leviathans were disporting themselves in its depths. Bubbles of carbonic acid will rise to the surface and burst and make rings 2 or 3 feet wide. Here and there, the grease and filth have caked solid, And the creek looks like a bed of lava. Chickens walk about on it, feeding. And many times an unwary stranger has wanted to stroll across and vanished temporarily. The packers used to leave the creek that way till every now and then the service would catch fire and burn furiously, and the fire department had to come and put out the river. That's what we're talking about. That's what was being shipped down the river down to the Mississippi, to St. Louis. So I will say that as a prelude before we talk a little bit about some counterfactuals, this case is actually being studied by one of the law professors here at the law school. Professor Janicki is looking at the consent decree that actually resolved this case a century ago. And I'll explain why in a minute. So, given what we just talked about, if this was just a case about proof, two questions then. Remember our other case on Monday, Georgia v. Tennessee Copper. Smelters here, state line here, desolation here. What if instead of two smelter operations laying indisputable waste to the land that the fumes were landing on, instead we had small smelters here in Georgia? Suppose the denuded landscape could also be attributed to drought or other factors. Is the only distinction here that we have a causation issue that makes the outcome indifferent in these two cases? Is there any other factor that you can point to as to why Georgia, the Tennessee Copper, might reach the same outcome?
Also, did Holmes say that it actually improved the river in some respects, that the fish came back? That's probably the part that maybe just...
Put it this way, there's some questions of whether or not there's a balancing of the evidence. The second question I was going to ask, and I guess I'll ask it now so we can let it marinate in the back of your head, is you're absolutely correct. There's sort of a sense as to not only causation, but balancing. What would happen if St. Louis could prove that 100 of its citizens died of typhus because of this discharge? But then Chicago proved that 1,000 people would have died in their city if they had. What does the balancing do in a public nuisance case in that scenario? Before we do that, any factors that differ between the two cases that says that if you muddy the waters, again, a terrible metaphor, in Georgia v. Tennessee Copper, do you reach the same outcome as Missouri v. Illinois? Or is there anything about the case that you can claim to hold to that injunction? That is a fascinating rabbit hole I'm strongly resistant going down, but I will make you a dark promise that we will go very deeply into joint and several liability and allocation of liability and joint tortfeasors when we get to Superfund. That is the alchemy of Superfund, and I will actually ask you guys to represent parties trying to reach a Superfund settlement based on joint and several liability and allocation. For now, I think that's really a question as to attribution, but it didn't affect the question of ultimately, did you have a claim in the first place? So, other than special solicitude, anything else? And the hint here is you guys already gave this answer earlier in the class. It was brilliant. Based on the names alone, what's the distinction between Missouri v. Illinois and Georgia v. Tennessee Copper?
It's two states versus
The obvious answer is the correct answer.
In this case, you have a sovereign versus a citizen, or actually, more accurately, a private party. Anything else? Because I like your answers. Isn't this exactly true also of Missouri v. Illinois? Special solicitude. Say what you will about the defendant being a sovereign. Pretty damn clear the plaintiff is a sovereign. Why aren't they entitled to special solicitude? Jack? Interesting. So a private party can't be in a position of unclean hands vis-a-vis a sovereign.
Well, they could. I mean, I'm saying that could apply to both things. I think any court's going to be reluctant to grant relief to a party if they're doing the same thing to which they're complaining of.
Okay.
It wasn't the case in Georgia v. Tennessee Copper, but it could have been.
No, that's a fair point. And I think what I would highlight for everyone here is that perhaps special solicitude was applied.
Okay.
But on both sides, they balanced each other out. So effectively, if both sides get that thumb in the scales, it still cancels each other out. The other is sovereign versus a private party. So if, for example, the city of St. Louis sued rather than the state of Missouri, and the city of St. Louis was deemed not to be a state entity. That's a tricky legal question. You might have had a situation where you didn't have that balance of sovereigns, that one side being the crown, the other one being a private party. I'm mentioning this because I just want to highlight that it's more than just, perhaps, proof. That there are some other factors in terms of the nature of the parties and the nature of the claims that might still preserve Georgia v. Tennessee Copper despite Missouri v. Illinois, even in a counterfactual situation like this. Now, my second question, remember that one? What happens when you do a balance of equities when there are lives on both sides? Any thoughts as to whether that's permissible? Can Chicago say, hey, that's really bad news. I'm so sorry to hear about that. My body stack's higher than yours, and you gotta shoulder up to take this one.
Wouldn't that be similar to someone saying, what I'm doing on my land is helping me a lot, so you're gonna have to shoulder the costs, and it's a terrible nuisance, it's there to stop. So I have this smokestack that's making me a lot of money, it's great. You're getting cancer from it, so for you, I'm making more money in your land business.
Isn't that exactly the holding of the Ducktown case?
So if you apply that to where our populace is doing better, well, you're not allowed to make some other populace worse and make yours better. Because you're not affecting your neighbors in the same way.
So if we were to, again, massage the facts, and St. Louis was suing because their waterfront property was now useless, because everyone's scared to get on land that might have Titan's bacilli on it, and it's worth $1 million. Chicago says, too bad, so sad. This work improves the value of our city property by $100 million. St. Louis gets damages, but they can't stop the discharge, even though they're both sovereigns.
Maybe it's about money in this.
Okay. Damages versus equity. I'll be honest, I'm asking this question because I wrestle with it. I don't know if there is an answer to this. I think any court would say you can't force a sovereign to accept an injury to the citizens of its state to benefit another state's citizens just because there's a difference in the body count. But I also have to say it happens in terms of air pollution crossing state borders. And one state can say that it injures their citizens. The other state that's emitting it says, well, if we don't allow it, if we have to do other things, it hurts our citizens more. Even though it's not counted in terms of lives, the dollars are effectively surrogates. But I don't know. My sense is a court would not nakedly balance equitable factors involved in the sovereignty of the state and the health and well-being of the citizenry. But I admit it's a little slippery. I'm sorry, Chad, do you have any that for you?
Yeah,
but I'm curious. I was monologuing.
It seems almost like constitutionally questionable for a federal court to come in and mandate, one, that they can either continue this policy that's going to kill Missourians, or B, like mandate what the public policy of Chicago would be, like some type of like anti-federalistic principle, like an encroachment of the federal government. But I don't know anything about constitutional law, so.
Well, that's not true. You've had con law. You're an expert now. Professor Ray would be very proud of you right now. And I'll be honest with you, though, I do not know the answer in the sense of that. Clearly, it became a problem. Now, you have to weed through the federalist canons and the decisions dealing with the limitation of the sovereignty of the federal government to impose liability on states, period. But having said that, I think the real root of it is the unpleasant notion of a court being forced to balance which citizens of which state matter more. But I can't put a finger on a clear legal principle that says why they can step back other than perhaps a political question.
Don't they,
don't
the courts have to weigh those matters in court all the time, like in wrongful death cases? So mm-hmm. Like, what's the, why would they take pause at valuing the remainder of 1,000 Chicagoans' lives versus 100 Missourians' lives? It doesn't seem like something that would be that far-fetched.
I would agree with you if we changed the context. If an agency promulgated a rule that was predicated on a cost-benefit assessment where they looked at the values of a course of action, one had a higher body count than the other, and that based on that difference in the statistical value of the lives being lost, they chose one route of action, that probably would pass any arbitrary capricious test. I'm thinking more in terms of a direct equity-based injunction issued by the court that effectively said Illinois can force Missouri to accept death in favor of Illinois citizens. And again, this is something I'm wrestling with. That's why I'm asking you guys. I'm hoping that I'm not alone in wrestling with what seems to be a slippery but important notion. But at this point, I'll have to stop and perhaps offer anyone, if they'd like, a good 21-year-old Japanese single malt whiskey if you want to talk about it further around the table sometime, because we have to move on. Any thoughts or questions about the fundamental kernel of public nuisance? The thing I want you to take away, I'll save time, but not writing the board behind me, but I'll simply say it as clearly as possible. Public nuisance is different than private nuisance because it deals with a different kind of harm. It deals with injuries to held in common by the public. It doesn't matter the number of parties. I can have 100,000 individual private nuisance claims. It's still not public unless the injury is to the harm by the right held by the public at large. And states and sovereigns usually are charged with protecting those commonly held rights, but private citizens can bring those claims if they have a special injury. Sorry, I thought you were raising your hand for a second. Okay. All right. So, with that in mind, I promised you one last thought, which is, what if this case were brought today, and we didn't have the Supreme Court tasking some court clerk to sift through the affidavits? It'd be in a lower court. The lower court would impanel a jury. The jury would be charged with assessing the facts. And then the trial judge would impose a judgment based on the determinations by the jury. Now, that means this whole issue of higher standard of proof, given the unique original jurisdiction of the case, doesn't come into play. How do you protect those same interests in a public nuisance case when it's actually being brought under normal procedures? And I'll suggest a few things. Number one, yes, the jury gets to make the call. But the jury, yes.
I have another question.
Of course.
Or would it be a jury that's
again, first, let me be honest with you. I think the odds of this kind of case being filed, for reasons we'll talk about hopefully in a few minutes, are unlikely simply because there's so much non-statutory overlay on it. Let's assume you filed a tort lawsuit. Let's assume it's a nuisance lawsuit. Let's assume it's a public nuisance or private nuisance lawsuit. Which court's the place you can sue? The answer is yes. You can sue in Illinois local court, be it federal district court, federal or state court, because that's the site where the defendant resides, and you can usually find venue and jurisdiction there. And you might be suing under Illinois law, but nonetheless, you have a venue. Or you might sue in Missouri, if you have some basis exercise jurisdiction over a non-resident defendant upstream. But then in that case, you're absolutely right. You have a hometown judge, a hometown jury, and maybe the Missouri law applied rather than Illinois law. Depends on the choice of law standard. A good question, an important question, and we weave into this, but for now I just want to focus on how do you get to the heart of the issues that the, Justice Holmes is talking about. And here, the jury gets to decide, but the jury has to decide based on expert testimony, typically. You're not going to be floating bags of bacilli and having the judge try to read the data results. You're not going to have interpretation statistical analysis showing what the spike in deaths of cholera are in St. Louis. Instead, it's going to be a question of whether or not that expert on either side, their experts will be able to reach conclusions that will be credible to the jury more than their opponents. So how does the process deal with this sort of shifting of the locus of decision? I just want to suggest to you that the judge still plays a critical role by determining which experts get to testify. Judges are still charged with screening which experts can tell a jury what they think. Usually that's under a Tobar standard. In fact, we'll talk about later in the semester, but essentially the judge gets to say whether or not that expert evidence is scientifically credible enough to not be a, what's the word I'm struggling for here? Prejudicial to the jury. That means usually this fight's going to be fought over what's called a lone pine order. Essentially, it's a pretrial order that essentially, filed by defendants, essentially say, put up or shut up. This case should not proceed further in discovery. It should not proceed further in substantive motions until the plaintiffs satisfy an initial demonstration they have enough credible scientific evidence that would ultimately be possibly pass this bar review with a federal judge to allow the case to proceed. Some of you, maybe many of you in this room, will be tasked with reviewing and writing lone pine orders if you do any kind of toxic tort work or environmental litigation. Podcast, have any of you had a chance to involve that already? Have you seen any of those in the court by any chance? Basically, a pretrial order forcing the plaintiffs to disclose their scientific expert testimony to make sure the judge will allow it.
Oh, okay. Dollars.
Sorry?
A dollar?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote
really? For who? I'm sorry. Well, don't share confidential information. But I'd love to talk with you about it afterwards. Yeah, but they're fascinating.
They
essentially.
Are. And like, the what is allowed in.
Usually, but I will also say I've seen a stiletto to the heart in some cases if you do win on a lone pine order. They just basically, there's nothing you can do. You can't, your case dies. All right, so any questions? Is this all gel for everybody? You feel comfortable with public and private nuisances? Because here's the other gateway issues I said I'd like to talk about before time runs out tonight. In particular, number one, which law applies? And here the issue is displacement for federal claims. The question is preemption for state claims. And if you don't have displacement or preemption, choice of law principles. Getting to our hypothetical about if you wanted to sue, would you do it in Missouri or to do it? So our displacement case for tonight as one of the most influential and important for your exercise next week So fairly briefly and straightforwardly, would anyone like to give us a quick walkthrough on the Connecticut versus American Electric Power decision? One of the few rare unanimous decisions you will see from this court, written by the notorious RPG. Sorry, were you saying yeah or just stretching? Ah, okay. I thought we had a cheer here. I was very encouraged. I think my string of luck has run out. Chad, you gotta throw yourself on the grenade here? Megan offering an able assist.
So several plaintiffs brought a public nuisance claim against.
I will interrupt you. Plaintiffs of what nature?
Plaintiffs private and public.
Who is the private?
Several states, city of New York, and three private.
There you go.
Brought public nuisance against carbon dioxide emitters, four private power companies, and the TVA, seeking public nuisance for their emissions. And the court said that bypassing the
air. I'm going to slow down a little bit here. I want to pass for everyone a small flag. TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, it's worth circling when you see that plaintiff. TVA is a federal government agency. It just doesn't sound like one. It's a unique one in the sense of that it is one of the few agencies that can tell the Department of Justice to stuff it. They can bring their own cases and they can appear before the Supreme Court even if the Solicitor General doesn't want them to. That's why you see TVA showing up a lot of times all by its lonesome when the U.S. government is not necessarily wanting to get involved in it. So I just raise that because TVA will show up in the second issue we're going to talk about, this preemption. Sorry, keep going.
So the...
If you mind, one other question. What was the relief they were seeking?
They were seeking injunctive relief.
So no dollars?
No dollars.
And what was the injunctive relief?
Stop producing carbon dioxide.
Shut down the power grid for the Northeast?
To cap their...
Right, so not get worse at least,
and then work your way down.
Right. Vaguely EPA-ish, but nonetheless. It's equitable related. Okay.
And so maybe I don't know how far
you want to go. No, you're doing good now. I just I should warn you, I was involved in this case, so it's hard for me not to interrupt you because I will tell a story about it when you get to the right point, then I'll get out of your way. So let's keep going.
So the defendants in this case were arguing that the federal common law, quote unquote, public nuisance was preempted by the passage of the Clean Air Act and establishment of the EPA.
Okay.
And the court agreed with them, so dismissed the public nuisance claim.
All right. Let me grab what you said and offer a few thoughts. The case, I think, rather specific, but did you remember what the trial court ruling was?
The trial court ruling, I think this is the one that said it was non-justiciable.
Now, let's give you a chance to bask in glory now. Okay. Yes, the Southern District of New York is the original trial in this case. If there was no trial on the merits, it was disposed of with dispositive motions. And we represent, so far as I had the privilege of going up to the Southern District to watch this argument. Picture a courtroom bigger than this, completely filled, standing room only with lawyers, no public, all representing parties. That's how big the interest was. There were lawyers in the hallway listening to the case being broadcast with the speaker. The argument lasted all day, the entire day. Judge Prescott, bless her, she did a fantastic job. And she basically threw it into the bin, saying it was a political question. And I'm assuming everyone here recalls from their con law class, y'all talked about political question. I'll just I'll do a little bit of a cheat here and simply say the part of the Baker v. Carr factors that she invoked were the first two, that it was not susceptible to a judicial standard decision. There's no legal standard to apply in this situation. What's an appropriate amount of CO2 to emit by common law purposes? You're dealing with global issues. You couldn't decide. Second, that it was also constitutionally committed to another branch. In this case, the legislature. This is the sort of problem that the courts were uniquely intended to resolve. And that was it. It went up to the Second Circuit, and to our great astonishment, the Second Circuit reversed. Said there was standing. Said that there was not a political question. Said that there was an ability to hold the parties liable, even though there was free admission by the plaintiffs that they were a minuscule contributor to global climate change emissions. And that it was appropriate to use equitable relief to require them to reduce emissions and remanded back to trial. That's when we got the Supreme Court. So sorry for this, the long segue there, Jeff. I thought that kind of gave a little bit of texture and flavor to it. So you said that it was, the court basically determined that it was preempted?
That it was displaced, but I don't know if there's really a difference.
Ah!
You have displacement written for federal, so I'm going to go with that.
What is the difference?
That they can't bring the claim anymore because this has replaced whatever draws a public nuisance claim because it's been legislatively accounted for.
What's the difference? What's one versus the other? Why do I care if I call it displacement rather than preemption? Can't tell if Jack's just thinking or if he's
just thinking.
Okay.
I mean, it's a good point. It's fine.
You want me to answer the question?
Well, you're wearing a suit, so you're kind of obligated to.
Great. Well, displacement because you're displacing federal common law with actual other federal law, which is more specific to the nature of whatever thing you're trying to bring in. Whereas preemption is the federal law just moves above the state law. That's not really, you can't, so like it's wiping the federal law away. It's not really displacing the preemption, which is more accurate.
Absolutely. And your hand gestures capture perfectly the nature of what you're talking about. Displacement is horizontal. It is a federal action displacing another federal action. So the constitutional values implicated are much less significant. It is much easier to displace as opposed to preempt, which is vertical, top down. There, you're impinging the sovereignty of the state that has issued its own laws and saying federal law is going to take predominance. So courts are much more reluctant to preempt a state law as opposed to displacing a federal common law state. So here, basically, Justice Ginsburg, 8-0, said, displacement solves this problem. Now, since time is running short, let me add a few grace notes. It's more than that. This decision has implications moving forward because Justice Ginsburg also ruled a couple of other things. One, the act of legislating is enough to displace, even if EPA refused to do another thing. It's a legislative allocation of power deal with the issue, the empowerment of EPA to promulgate regulations, that's enough to displace federal common law. That was particularly relevant because when this case was originally started, 2004, George W. Bush administration, where we were fighting exactly where not EPA was going to regulate. Number two, the decision also had a secret part that the book misses entirely, so I can't really warn it. But I'll simply say it's unique in that it's unanimous. 8-0, small trivia question, why would it be 8-0? The ninth justice was Justice Sotomayor, who at the time was Judge Sotomayor when it was before the Second Circuit, so she recused herself. She actually was on the panel in the Second Circuit. But having said that, there is also a 4-4 decision, an even split. So the Second Circuit was preserved on this one issue. It's dealt with in a footnote. It's standing. Apparently, the justices were evenly split on whether or not states have the ability to bring claims at all because they had been injured in a way that provided the concrete, particularized injury in fact that could be fairly attributed to the defendants and could be remedied by the court. Okay?
That's just Mass v. EPA, right? That's the same thing.
Mass v. EPA does talk about that, and you're right, that's the precedent specifically involved, but the Mass v. EPA is not a tort case, so I want to be careful about standing.
Okay, but I guess it's the same sort of injury question?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. And now I've lost my train of thought because I'm such a good question. No, no, that's all right. All right. Bear with me. It'll come to me as I finish up here. I'll simply say, because of that 4-4 split, there's a lot of concern and focus on what both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh's opinion is, because that standing issue could shift in a fundamental way, in which case some of these questions we're talking about are gone. If you can't have standing, political question doesn't matter. Proof and equitable relief doesn't matter. Yes?
Why is this standing different than asking?
We'll talk about that, so I'll give you a quick preview. Mass v. EPA involved, yes, concrete factual injuries, loss of shoreline by Massachusetts, for example, but it also involved procedural injury. The fact that they had a right to have their claim dealt with in a particular way under the Clean Air Act. And with procedural injuries, you actually don't have to prove redressability. So there's some thought that in addition to quasi-sovereign status, in addition to the concrete Article 3, there's also a separate procedural injury that could add an extra boost to the claim. I'll be honest with you, that's one of the most murky and opaque areas of standing law. So we'll talk about that on Wednesday of next week. Okay. All this means, as a final thought, as we move away, basically, we're going to talk later in this semester about the Trump administration's attempt to roll back the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. Now, that essentially is going to say the exact plants we're talking about in this case are not going to be subject to regulatory permit limits on CO2 emissions of the same type. Now, there is a strong debate within the Trump administration as to whether or not that's not far enough. They would like to actually go to the heart of the issue by saying that the Clean Air Act does not give the EPA the power to regulate CO2 emissions at all. Now, pause for a minute and think about, given this case, what the implications of that decision might be. If the EPA said, there is no statutory authority here, what happens to displacement? It's happy hunting, isn't it? That's why there's actually some of the strongest advocates for not doing that were the defendants, the energy companies. They want to preserve what we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, the endangerment finding, which gives EPA the power to regulate CO2. And have some form of regulation, even if it's not as aggressive as the Obama regulations, so that they can preserve that. Layers within layers within layers. Okay. All clear? Okay. Then, very briefly, let me offer a final thought, and then I might save choice of law issues and perhaps the Houston Ship Channel example I asked you to think about at the end of our last class. We'll save that for the start of next Wednesday. But basically, preemption is that verbal situation, top down. Now, the book does not have this case, but let me suggest to you, here's your takeaway. The North Carolina v. Tennessee Valley Authority case, Fourth Circuit. It's actually the end of the spectrum. That decision was extraordinarily aggressive and said, if you've got a federal clean air permit, you can't be sued in tort under state law. It doesn't make sense otherwise. If you get a permit from the federal government or from the state agency authorized by the federal government, and then suddenly after the fact you get smacked with a tort action that requires to do something different, that doesn't make sense. That's a straight up conflict preemption. It's also a field preemption. It's also an implicit preemption. So, Fourth Circuit made this very aggressive ruling, and interestingly enough, after TVA won, they immediately turned around and gave the plaintiffs everything they wanted. The pollution controls, the remediation, the permit limits. Why would they do that? Why would you win a court case and then you have to write a check for everything the plaintiffs want? And by the way, think Machiavellian. That's natural. Chad's thinking Machiavellian. Kyle's thinking the evil Sims were right. They bought a precedent. All right, that's a personal opinion. I will tell you, no one told me that at TVA, but the general impression in the environmental community was very strong. They wanted to freeze this precedent in amber, and they were happy to write the check to do so. Now, here's the thing I want to stress to you that the book doesn't really capture, is that they are not alone. The Sixth Circuit is also, and the Second Circuit, have both said there is no preemption necessarily in this context. So I'm going to suggest that any of you who are looking for future practice areas or potential Supreme Court practice, this is teed up and will almost certainly be going to Supreme Court probably the next 3 to 5 years. And I can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun. So with that, displacement, preemption, we'll say choice of law issues and where to sue, and then I'll talk with you next Wednesday about flying Asian carp, which is not a rock band, and the possibility of using tort law on situations like Houston Ship Channel, where you can have thousands of plaintiffs and hundreds of defendants all dealing with pollution. What are the issues, and more importantly, what are the ways to get it dismissed? And then I'll send you by email tonight or person tomorrow the rebalancing of the teams and the short factual predicates you guys can come to class they did about on Wednesday. Not to spoil your holidays, but something that you that has to come. Take a breath. Any questions? Things you want to kick around? Philosophical insights? You ready to go to your next one, Sis? Sad. Very sad. Okay. Have a great holiday weekend. I'll see everyone next Wednesday.